Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. Fewer companies are throwing office Christmas parties these days, but if you still crave that unbridled mayhem, you can find it in a new film called Office Christmas Party without even having to deal with annoying coworkers, a hangover, or all those morning after regrets. It's the latest feature from co-directors Will Speck and Josh Gordon, whose previous films are Blades of Glory and The Switch. It has an all-star cast that includes Jason Bateman, Jennifer Aniston, Olivia Munn, Vanessa Bayer, Kate McKinnon, Courtney B. Vance, and T.J. Miller. It opens wide this Friday, and I'm very pleased to welcome its two directors to our show today. Hello.
Hey.
Hi. How's it going?
Bloomberg News reports that Christmas office parties have gone from 83% in 1998 to 65% last year. Ugh. What do you think has led to their decline? The messiness of the drunken carousing, or all those things that were better left unsaid?
You know, I think it's kind of a combination of things. I think corporate America has valued their workers less and less as we go. And I think the little perks, the things that they used to kind of allow and pay for, have sort of gone the way of other budget cuts like overtime and healthcare. But I also think that social media really put a dent in it. I think people getting recorded at their Christmas events and passed around, I think it ended enough careers that people started to shy away from it.
It's sort of the era of HR and liability, where I think there was a time where that didn't exist as much, and we're trying to sort of bring that back.
Although you do deal with that in this film.
Yeah.
Initially in the film, there's not going to even be this kind of office party at all at Zenitech, where the film takes place. What sets it in motion?
What's that? What
changes their mind and allows them to
have
the
what
party?
Shifts it? Well, you know, they're a struggling branch. They're the Midwest branch of a large corporation. And Jennifer Aniston's character runs the New York branch, and her brother runs this, you know, Chicago branch. And what changes their mind is that she's basically trying to close the branch. And the only thing they can do to save themselves is to land a client who's worth a big piece of their business. And the thing that they come up with is that they're going to throw a great Christmas party because they've got one day to scramble to get this guy's business and in turn hopefully saving themselves.
Had you been looking for a while for what to follow your last film, The Switch, with, did you always know that it was going to be another comedy?
We did. I mean, yeah. I think, you know, we have a large appetite for making different kinds of movies, but I think what we do unify our sensibility on is that we always can find the humor in something. And I think we wanted to find something that was a very universal subject that everybody either has firsthand experience with or knows somebody that's gone to an office Christmas party, that it wasn't a comedy based on a contrivance. And I think that was what was appealing to us.
And people will recognize a lot of the stuff here. That was an important part. On the other hand, the night does get kind of wild. Someone literally does swing from the ceiling on a string of Christmas lights.
That doesn't happen.
Your intention was to show people at the most dysfunctional?
I think so. I mean, I think for Will and I, you know, we did work in some offices over the years, but I think we never got to go to a lot of the big Christmas parties or holiday parties. And I think for us, this was an opportunity to throw the one that we wish we had gone to, and now we feel like we've experienced
it. We're also hoping that we subtly suggest some new traditions that can be adopted, like the cocaine snow machine.
Oh, I thought that this was based on the Geico Christmas party.
We weren't invited to that.
The movie is based, as we said, on people who will remind the audience of folks they're familiar with.
Yeah.
the part of the branch, President Clay, is of vital importance because if you don't believe him or in him, the whole thing falls apart. Where did you find T.J. Miller? She's the least famous member of the cast.
Yeah, you know, this movie changes that because he deserves to be right up there with the rest of them. T.J. was somebody actually who came to us through our advertising work. We did a Motorola campaign where he played a very lazy version of a smartphone that wasn't doing what the people wanted them to do. And when we were on set with him, he was so inventive and so smart, and we sort of had him up our sleeve always as the lead and the boss that you really wish you had. And I think what happened was, because of Silicon Valley,
his career kind of caught up to our ambition for him, which
yeah,
is great.
And he was so great in Deadpool, and I think it was just enough momentum behind him to have Spielberg in the studio say, you know what, let's take a chance on this guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you didn't have to take a chance on some of the other people in the film. His sister, played by Jennifer Aniston, kind of ruthless CEO of the company.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't Jason Bateman star with Jennifer Aniston in your last film, The Switch?
He did, yeah.
I mean, the good news is we had their cell phone numbers.
Right, so we could bully them into it.
Exactly.
I think we had such a good time working with them on The Switch, and we knew we wanted to find something to do with them again, but we wanted to give them kind of the opportunity to explore different versions of what they're capable of. And so Jen, you know, who is an incredibly nice person in real life, for some reason has this great skill at tapping into ruthless cruelty. And Jason, to us, you know, we bonded over a lot of the same movies, and we love The Apartment, which is the Billy Wilder movie. And to us, you know, Bateman really is sort of a Jack Lemmon for this time. He's a great reactor. He's great at sort of holding the center of a movie.
And then from Saturday Night Live, you have a woman who's become a major star. She can play pretty much anything.
Yeah.
Kate McKinnon, who plays Mary here, the very by-the-rules head of human resources. But now that we've seen her as both Hillary Clinton and Kellyanne Conway, I'm convinced she can play anybody.
Well,
here.
She definitely plays both sides of the political fence very well. You know, we had always loved Kate, and I think what she does that's very unique, and, you know, our first movie had Will Ferrell in it, and he did a similar thing, is, you know, she's not just a sketch performer. All of those characters she plays, they always have a full emotional life and idiosyncratic versions of those kind of tropes. And I think for our HR director, we felt like if anybody can subvert the rules, it's Kate McKinnon.
And you decided to write backstories in your mind for all of these
people?
We
did. I mean, for us, it was very important to kind of have everybody. We wanted to make a large ensemble movie, but we didn't want people to just be extras or to have incomplete stories. And to us, that's the thing about the Christmas party, the holiday party. You know, it's a moment for anybody to kind of have their breakthrough. And so we really worked very hard, even though some of them are only one or two scene arcs, to have everybody kind of arc in a way.
You also, from Saturday Night Live, have Vanessa Bayer.
Yeah.
But it's hard to think of Courtney B. Vance of The People versus O.J. Simpson as being in a situation like this. How did you think about casting him as Walter Davis, the client that they need to convince to stay with them?
I think giving that role a little bit of a spirit of enigma was important to us. I think we wanted the audience, like the characters in the movie, to not know if they could sway this guy. And I think, you haven't seen him in the comedy space. We saw him on Broadway, actually, in Six Degrees of Separation when we were in college together at NYU, and just have always loved his dramatic work. OJ, that blew us away as Cochrane. And I think having him have that gravitas and weight really helped propel the movie because you just don't know where he's going to go.
How much did you go into the various characters' backstories with the actors?
Pretty extensively.
Quite a lot. Yeah. I mean, we also sat with the actors when we cast them and brought them into the writing process a little bit, you know.
Because you have all of these comic actors.
And they're
I'm
so
assuming
additive.
They wanted to improvise.
Yeah, there were 18 of them.
So you want to kind of make them your partners in this so that when they are improvising, they're in your headspace and they're giving you stuff that you can use. And that was great. It was a great process.
My guests are Will Speck and Josh Gordon, whose latest film is Office Christmas Party, and it opens wide, as they say, this coming Friday. So I can't go through all the names of all the theaters. You had Kate McKinnon sing a German song.
That was her idea. Yeah. I think, you know, everybody has their moment with Courtney B. Vance's character, Walter, the client that they're trying to woo. And I think some of those, as all awkward Christmas party moments can be didn't go as well as others. And Kate's idea was that she was of German descent and had a great Christmas carol that she could slowly and quietly sing to him.
When you have a cast that's this heavy with comic actors and comedians, does it require two people to to direct?
You know,
keep things under control.
Yes, is the short answer.
I think any party is better with two hosts than one.
Yeah. You know, Will and I have worked together since NYU, and the advantage for us is that we share the same sensibility and we have a very smooth working relationship. But, you know, it allows you to not get overwhelmed. It allows you to kind of focus on all the things that are important as directors and not be, you know, not be stretched too thin, I think.
You shot it in Chicago, really in winter?
Yeah. Well, actually, it was in spring. And what we got really lucky on is normally in films, especially with the world right now, there's not as much snow as there used to be, sadly. And I think, you know, we knew that we were going to add some CG snow. And especially in the first act, the third act, there was a snowstorm. And we were sort of told by the studio in no uncertain terms that that was going to be very expensive. And it just so happened, luckily enough, that first day in April that we shot, it snowed, so it was a little bit of a sign.
And then, crazy enough, we went indoors the next day. It didn't snow. And then we went outdoors the third day, and it snowed again.
So when it snowed in
God
April,
wanted this
yes,
movie to
the
work.
Movie gods
yes,
wanted this
exactly.
to happen.
Somebody was on our side.
But you also had to direct reindeer.
Not a fun animal.
No.
Especially in the springtime.
Could you just put horns onto a dog? And
We pretty much did.
Yeah, we had to fashion lightweight horns to put on their head because they lose their horns, and then they lose their coats. They become really disgusting animals.
Yeah, exactly. April and reindeer do not go together.
In Atlanta.
Exactly.
It's not a good combination.
The movie also is very fast-paced. There's a lot of chaos going on. Is that something that only happens in the editing room?
I think we wanted it to feel like just when you thought you could sort of settle into one character story that you could subvert the expected and go to another one. So I think, you know, we shot a lot, but as you say, you know, in the editing room, we really paced it up because I think we wanted to keep people feeling like, as a moviegoer, you were at that party. And the way that you experience a party is you get your drink and you go from one side of the room to the other. And I think that was the emotion we wanted to carry when you were actually experiencing
it. I like that you just paced up your answer as you were talking.
You said that you've known each other since film school. Did you go into advertising first?
We did. I mean, we actually, when we graduated from film school, we worked on short films together.
Which is what most film students
exactly.
do.
Exactly. It was what we could afford to achieve at that point, and also, I think, emotionally, what we could kind of control. And one of them was nominated for an Oscar, and that got us sort of our first agent and got us signed at Ridley and Tony Scott's commercial company, RSA.
Where we got to do short films for advertising.
Right.
People.
It was a great learning experience.
Yeah.
Probably best known for the caveman and gecko commercials for Geico.
Yeah.
Sure. How far along before did you come up with them?
Or yeah, we pretty much invented them with that ad agency. I think, you know, they had done a very early version of a gecko that sort of wasn't taking on, and then they asked us to come on and design it with them. And we actually saw a theater actor in London in a play that we loved who we thought could be the voice, and that took some convincing, but they went with it. And
with the caveman, it was a great copywriter there named Joe Lawson, who ultimately went on to great success in TV. And with him, we kind of crafted that first campaign.
And we invented the idea that they were really gentrified and in our society. Originally, it was written that they were just in pelts holding clubs. And I think
we thought metrosexual caveman was a very funny.
It was time.
A lot of people have gone from doing commercials and music videos into feature films, but you go back and forth.
Yeah, I think, you know, for us, thankfully, we're at a stage in the advertising space where we do selective work that doesn't involve people holding up toothpaste and staring at the camera talking about plaque.
There's a great kind of artistry to commercials at a certain level, and they've been both a great learning experience as directors, but also we've been able to get our sensibility out there, which is kind of a great, you
but
know.
I also assume that because of the success of the ones you've done, people are more likely to sign you to do certain kinds of commercials, like the Apple commercial with Bill Hader.
Yeah. I think, there's sort of, you know, we get sent things that are always comedic, but that have a little bit of a subversive edge to them and some visual landscape. So
I'm going to ask you the question that seems to apply to pretty much every guest. in this new political era,
yes.
Do you think the tone and direction of comedies will change?
Hmm.
Do you think that if you make fun of Donald Trump, that he'll tweet about it sometime in the middle of
which
the
day? Which could help your movie.
That's become the new publicity.
I think people need comedy more now than they've ever needed it.
There's something that it's a great equalizer, and I think always traditionally, you know, when times are tough, I think people need escape. And, you know, the movies have always sort of spiked in harder times in our country, and I think, you know, it's a rough time for everybody, and I think something that gets people gathered into a communal space and has something where they can all laugh at the same moment is important.
Well, some of our greatest comedies were made during the Great Depression. I hope we're not going to have to go through something like that again.
I know.
My thanks to both of you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having us. We're big fans and love WNYC.
Will Speck, Josh Gordon, their film Office Christmas Party opens wide this Friday.
Go see it.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On Sunday, a North Carolina man was charged with assault with a deadly weapon after he entered a pizzeria in Washington, D.C., pointed a gun at an employee, and then fired shots inside the building. The man claimed to have been investigating a conspiracy that ties the pizzeria with a satanic cult, child abuse, and Hillary Clinton. It's the latest example of the power of fake news, which has surged during this election season. To try to understand this new epidemic, the people behind it, the people who share it, and why it goes viral, we are joined now by Terrence McCoy, social issues reporter for The Washington Post, and Shira Frenkel, cybersecurity correspondent for BuzzFeed News. Welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Shira, can you explain the conspiracy theory involving the pizzeria? It seems so far-fetched. It's hard to believe that anybody would take it seriously.
It does. And to be honest, I don't know if really getting into the detail is going to serve readers, other than to say it is one of many, many theories out there involving the Clintons, involving members of the Democratic Party, which are created to sort of paint them in as bad a light as possible. This one involves child sex escorts and other sort of lurid happenings at this particular pizza parlor. And I think it's interesting, this particular one, because it shows that nothing is so far-fetched that people are not willing to believe it when they see it online.
And one prominent person who's been spreading this rumor is the son of Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. Hasn't he been part of the Trump transition team?
He hasn't, and he has actually, you know, come out and tweeted, and even now in the wake of that attack, we haven't seen any kind of retraction from him. He's not the only member as well of Trump's team or people around him who have been tweeting fake news both during the campaign and afterwards.
One prominent company that's behind a lot of fake news online is Disinformedia, started by Justin Kohler. What's the goal of a company like that one?
Well, I think that there's a number of companies, and fake news has kind of become the very general term that we use to describe it all. What they are is just misleading or sometimes outright false news articles. And some are created by people here in the United States because they can turn a profit. Someone clicks on the article, someone shares the article, and they make money from advertisements. Quite a few of these other sites are run by teenagers in Macedonia and other parts of Europe because, again, they've seen this as a way to make money. And then, of course, there's the third category that people have worried about, and that's articles that are purposefully planted by other countries trying to sort of spur disinformation campaigns in the United States. And all of these combined have sort of created a climate where there's a lot of news items online or things purporting to be news items, which are meant to sort of mislead you or just kind of paint a worldview in which everything is a conspiracy.
I would say what we're seeing right now is very different than what we've seen in the past, and the fact that there's always been lots of misinformation that has bled into the American mainstream. But what we've seen now is almost the weaponization of misinformation as well as the monetization of misinformation. You look at a number of these websites, they have found a way to be able to exploit people's fears and biases and suspicions in order to turn a profit. And this is something that's new. There's always been misinformation in American culture. Back in 1938, Orson Welles, there was the War of Worlds that was said on radio, and hundreds and thousands of Americans phoned into local police stations to say they were worried about the Martians invading. I mean, this is something that's been going on for a long period of time where people are worried and they can be suspicious of things. But what's different now is the fact that people are turning big bucks off of this. They're making a lot of money off of people's suspicions.
In the case of Justin Kohler, he claims that he started his... disinformedia company as an attempt to discredit the so-called alt-right. It's obvious that his plan has backfired.
I was just going to say, yes, but News of the World also made money. I mean, these places, these tabloids have always made money. I think now the difference is that any Joe Schmo sitting in the back of his, you know, apartment can do this. You don't need a major newspaper. You don't need to print anything. You literally need nothing but the couple dollars it might take to sort of start a new site. So anyone can do this. Anyone in the world can do it. It makes them quite a bit of money. And there's no address to go to. There's no door to knock on to say, hey, stop this. Please, you know, discontinue what you've been doing. As opposed to the past, we sort of gatekeepers of the media that you could go and address.
Wasn't the Internet structured to be democratic, although no one seemed to have imagined that that would encourage the dissemination of fake news?
And that's what's interesting about this is the fact that misinformation in a number of key categories has advantages over information and fact. Misinformation can be molded to fit somebody's worldview or their personal biases. And when that happens, they're more likely to share it on their Facebook page, they're more likely to share it on their Twitter feed, and that can create these echo chambers where people are more or less just preaching to others, like-minded individuals. And it creates a self-reinforcing loop where one false or misleading story can ultimately become huge in this community because it fits all these people's personal beliefs. And fact and actual information all of a sudden becomes very weakened in that sort of environment because it doesn't fit those people's beliefs, so they're not going to share it. They're not going to put it out to their friends because they don't want to believe it. So in these situations, misinformation can become even more powerful than information can become.
And then when they distrust fact-checkers, if the New York Times or the Washington Post says that this is not true, that's just part of the conspiracy.
That's right, and that's one of the most dangerous things we're seeing right now is the fact that the New York Times did a big story on what we were talking about a moment ago with Comet Ping Pong Pizzeria in Washington, D.C., pretty much saying, you know, debunking this entire ludicrous conspiracy theory. But that actually reinforced it in a number of people's eyes because they perceive the New York Times to be a part of this liberal media establishment, and anything that they're writing is part of this lie. I actually experienced this myself when I did a story on a couple of guys who are writing a lot of misleading and misinformed articles out of a Long Beach apartment. After I wrote this article, these writers kind of used it as a way to say, look, the Washington Post lies. This is part of the fake news. They're part of the fake news more than we are, and it becomes a sort of back and forth where the people who are writing the fake news are accusing the mainstream media of doing fake news.
Sherry, you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to add for a moment about how sort of the Internet makes this all possible. Out here in San Francisco, that's the main thing that people are focusing on. We're talking about people whose entire lives are invested in the creation of the Internet. And looking at all this, they're sort of asking themselves, what happens next? I mean, they call this the sort of Wild West days of the Internet, where we're really just beginning to understand the capacity of what's possible. And on the one hand, people see the damage of fake news, especially major companies like Facebook and Twitter and Google, who are trying to figure out what to do next. On the other hand, the very principles that their companies are founded on is that sort of everything is shareable and everything should be shareable. And we should all be living our lives online and sharing information with people who we care about. So I think it's interesting to see these companies at sort of a real crossroads of their founding principles and sort of what to do next.
I'm speaking with Sherry Frenkel, cybersecurity correspondent for BuzzFeed News, and Terrence McCoy, the social issues reporter for The Washington Post. And Terrence, you mentioned that you went to meet these guys who in Long Beach who created a website called Liberty Writers News.
That's right. They created this website back in, I think it was June of this year, and they're more or less a case study in how quickly a group or a Facebook page or a website can tap into a surging ideology and use that to, or more or less just ride it into Internet notoriety or to the fact that these men who are both 26 years old, they started this Facebook page and they started this website 6 months ago, and in that amount of time they have nearly 1 million followers now on Facebook. This is a massive audience. And the way that they've been able to do that is a really clear case study of how a number of websites do it. It's more or less just kind of cultivating and inflaming a lot of people's biases and prejudices prejudices to the point where you can create a massive audience by every day kind of stoking or feeding those readers what they want. They're very clear about the fact that, say, we are part of the echo chamber, and our whole job is more or less just confirmation bias. There's a bias, and we're out there to confirm it. And the most important thing is to give readers what they want. And what readers wanted to read was that Hillary Clinton was going to jail, that Donald Trump was this avenging hero who was going to save America from villainous global financiers. This is what their audience wanted to read, and they had no problem giving that to them under the idea that this is just how capitalism works in America. You know, this is the way to make a buck, and we're going to make a buck doing it.
But don't these two gentlemen, Paris Wade and Ben Goldman, say that they're politically liberal? Is this just a very cynical way to make a buck? And how are they?
How are they making a buck? Both of them have voted for Barack Obama in 2008 as well as in 2012. They consider themselves more moderate. They've always been more culturally liberal. After 2012, when they both graduated college around that time, they went through a period of disillusionment where they became increasingly convinced that a lot of what Obama was saying about today's America was not true. So they do, to some extent, believe some of the things that they're writing, but also what they mostly believe is we want to be able to build an audience, and if we build an audience, we can make money off this. And the way that they make money off of this is by rapidly building this Facebook page, which will then channel readers into their website, in which they make lots of money off of these sort of splashy advertisements where you feel like when you go to their website, you're going to get a virus in your computer or something, like very graphic sort of advertisements.
And what kinds of companies advertise on these sites?
There's one company that they have two major advertisers, but just these sort of big Internet advertisers. AdSense, I believe, is one of them. That you buy through them, and they put advertisements on your website, and just that's how you turn a profit.
Well, Kellogg's just recently made a lot of people angry when it decided it wasn't going to put any ads on Breitbart. So there's often retribution if companies don't advertise in these places.
But there's also a back and forth where Kellogg, a lot of Breitbart readers say we're not going to buy cornflakes anymore. But on the other hand, a lot of folks who support Kellogg's decision, they're going to go out and buy cornflakes. It's kind of what we're seeing right now is this politicization of just basic commercial objects that we hadn't seen before. New Balance shoes is now the shoe of many white supremacists, and so they're going to go out and buy it. But folks who don't agree with that ideology aren't going to buy it. And this is something that I think is very new in both American commerce and American politics.
Now, in their articles, Wade and Goldman frequently write about globalists. What do they mean by that?
The globalist is kind of this, in a lot of new right and alt-right and far-right fringe sort of bloggers and people who are tweeting, it's kind of a catch-all term for this sort of shadowy financial elite, folks who want to tear down all the borders and make everything sort of a borderless free trade zone. And what the idea is that those sort of globalists are only in it for themselves, and they're not in it for the regular folks who are losing their jobs as a result of it. But they're doing it, and they're alleging that these so-called globalists are doing it in a massive collusive effort that spans from the United States across Europe through many, many countries, pretty much in cahoots with one another in order to disenfranchise many of the working class people.
Sounds like an update of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Or the Illuminati, you're right. Yeah.
And they say that they've been using the headline, "The media doesn't want you to see." They've used it 1,000 times, beyond the fact that that's grammatically incorrect. That does make a point to the kinds of people who read their articles. Did they play a role in the Pizzagate conspiracy?
No, that's interesting. I actually did a search for that yesterday to see if they had, but they had not, from what I could tell. But when I was out there with them, the Pizzagate conspiracy was at first just starting. I was with them from November 8th, the night of the election, for a couple days afterward. And the Pizzagate conspiracy theory really started going at the end of October. But this was something that they definitely had on their radar, that they were asking me about it even. They're like, "Have you heard of this place called Comet?" And I was like, "You know, it's a pizzeria." But apparently what they were seeing in a lot of their circles of people sharing the different stories was that, you know, this was what they were alleging it to be. And so they didn't play a role in it, but they definitely had their finger on the pulse of a lot of these sort of conspiracy theories that are percolating.
An interesting part of that conspiracy was that much of this activity was taking place in the basement, and it turns out the pizzeria doesn't have a basement. But, you know, let's not confuse ourselves with facts. My guests are Terrence McCoy, social issues reporter for The Washington Post, Shira Frenkel, cybersecurity correspondent for BuzzFeed News. We will continue our conversation after this. We're talking about fake news with Terrence McCoy, social issues reporter for The Washington Post, and Shira Frenkel, cybersecurity correspondent for BuzzFeed. Shira, what's Facebook's official position on fake news?
Well, we've seen their position shift. Right after the election, Mark Zuckerberg gave an open sort of policy speech in which he said that it was a crazy idea that Facebook and the fake news published on Facebook had affected these elections. And I think in the wake of that, he saw sort of such a severe backlash that the company has now taken a much more nuanced stance. And we've seen them, along with Twitter and Google and other companies, sort of come together and potentially say, we're going to try and work on this and come up with a policy and come up with a strategy. And Facebook has been beta testing a number of different sort of solutions. One includes having readers flag fake news or misleading news as they see it on their Facebook feeds. But I think they're struggling because they don't want to be the arbitrators of news. I think they understand that if Facebook starts deciding what's news and what's not news, it opens them up for a host of problems. On the other hand, they've let this go on for so long, and such a great number of fake news sites are now proliferating on their platform that they know they have to do something. So I think we're going to see in the next couple months a number of things being tested across the platform to try and stop fake news sites from continuing there.
Academics and Facebook employees have said that Facebook's algorithm is designed in a way that perpetuates fake news stories.
Well, Facebook's algorithm is designed in a way that it perpetuates whatever echo chamber you're in. So it looks at what you click on, it looks at what you like, your friends sharing, and then it keeps giving you that. And so whatever your worldview is, whether it's that, you know, Trump should be the president or that Clinton should have won, it's going to encourage that. And I think, unfortunately, we live in a world where the most salacious sort of news, the most salaciously written articles are the ones that make it to the top of our news feed. It's the ones we click on or potentially like or share. And so Facebook keeps giving those to us. And, yeah, it's a question of whether they tweak their algorithms. But, I mean, what can they do if that's what people want to share? If people want to share sort of the most gruesome thing they've seen that day.
It could lead to me not being able to share my opinions about somebody, a coworker, for example. They're afraid of censorship, I imagine. But doesn't the company now have an unofficial task force dedicated to stopping fake news?
Right. So that's something I wrote about in the week following the election, essentially following Zuckerberg's comment that it was crazy. I think that really ignited a group of Facebook employees to try and tackle it themselves. And they sort of went rogue. They started meeting secretly within the company and tried to come up with a method internally to solve this problem. Facebook then, a week later, announced that it also had an official group within the company that was working on it. So they're now trying to be seen publicly as really doing something to address this. But even within the company, the people I'm continuing to speak with say, is this too little, too late? Where were we months ago when all of this was feeding into the sort of crazy news cycle around these elections?
But didn't the Facebook employees prefer to speak to you anonymously? Are they meeting in secret?
They're meeting in secret, and to this day they've only spoken anonymously because they have to sign. I mean, Facebook has non-disclosure agreements upon non-disclosure agreements. And so all of them were sort of breaking those agreements with the company in order to speak to me and were fearful of not just losing their jobs but no longer being able to work within the tech industry if they did speak with their legal names.
Is this issue connected to Facebook's previous controversy when the website Gizmodo reported that Facebook employees were pushing liberal-leaning stories on the trending topics page?
I don't think it is. And in fact, quite a few of the Facebook employees I spoke to weren't doing this from a political mindset. They weren't doing it because Trump won or they wanted Hillary to win. And quite a few of them actually talked about what a massive problem this is outside of the United States. And that's something I've been writing about quite a bit recently. I traveled to Myanmar, where fake news is encouraging vicious attacks against Muslims living in Myanmar by Buddhist monks who run articles saying that, you know, that hordes of Muslims are killing Buddhists in Thailand and other such things and ignite these kind of mobs to go attack Muslims living in Myanmar. So this is a problem here in the United States, where we already have outlets like NPR and the New York Times that have been operating for years and that people trust and depend on. But what happens in the rest of the world when there isn't that kind of steady media climate, when they don't have reliable news sources and the only thing they're seeing is fake news articles online? And so these Facebook employees were saying, we're looking at the rest of the world now. We're looking at where Facebook is trying to expand globally and saying, we've got to get this under control before those countries sort of ignite civil wars on the basis of things that are published on our platforms.
Would stopping anonymity help?
I mean, Facebook already has a sort of a real name policy where people are meant to be using their real name. Of course, that's very, very difficult to enforce across the company. And I don't know that anonymity would necessarily help, because a lot of people are quite sort of proud about the things they post online, and whether those articles are fake or misleading or whatnot, they're happy to be at the helm of anything that sort of gets popular support and gets shared widely.
Terrence, did Wade and Goldman tell you that they, in some cases, their articles outperform real news articles online?
Yeah, I would say a perfect sort of encapsulation of that is a number of months ago, Hillary Clinton gave a speech about the alt-right, and they put the video up on her Facebook page, or they put it up on her YouTube, and then there was sort of a countervailing narrative about what that speech was, and that was put out by this man who runs Danger or Play, and his video far outperformed what his video, pretty much poking fun of and insulting what she was saying, far outperformed what she had put out there. There is this right now, we're seeing that, and they would talk about this, Liberty Writers News, they would say, you know, our impact on social media was such, and it was greater than a lot of legacy news organizations.
And hasn't Facebook banned or blocked some of their articles?
What happens is Facebook has a number of algorithms, and what they suspect, I mean, Facebook isn't very open about how these algorithms sometimes work, but what they suspect is that if a article starts trending in a very large fashion from an unverified source, a source that doesn't have one of those blue check marks, Facebook might automatically assume that this is spam or something to that effect, and they will temporarily ban that. And this is something that does temper to some degree some of these alt-right or fringe sort of outlets, these underground outlets are writing, but it doesn't catch all of them, and that's only for something that's going exceptionally viral. For a number of other articles, it kind of flies underneath that, and those can simmer for a long period of time. And what we see is that those articles, when they're written in such a way, when they target emotions, because a lot of these articles just target emotions, they don't target people's sort of sentience or what they are thinking. It's all about the emotive core, and when you target someone's emotive core, they just reshare without even thinking themselves. It just kind of goes from one person to the next. And that is really what we see become almost like a digital wildfire. It flames, and then it goes everywhere. Before you know it, it's just kind of suffocating an entire echo chamber.
And where do they get the ideas for their articles? Are they picking up other people's ideas? Or are they just making them up? How much is inspired by people like Alex Jones?
A lot of it is. I mean, it's not just the writers I wrote about. It's a number of, I mean, a lot of the writers that Cher was talking about in Macedonia. What it is the fact that in, to a certain degree, there is no bound to what people will believe. I mean, people were believing that this pizzeria was running a international syndicate, a crime syndicate from their basement that doesn't even exist. I mean, that shows how far people will believe things. But at the same time, there needs to be, it's almost like these sort of gumshoe activities where they're trying to connect the dots together to some extent, and almost like bits and pieces where there's one shred of what they claim to be evidence that they'll then say represents a much broader something out there. The Podesta emails were just an incredible well of material for all of these conspiracy theorists, because they could just read into any of these emails whatever they believed, and they could just say that this email meant this or that, or this or that, and it just spawned just innumerable number of conspiracy theories. The WikiLeaks drops spawned innumerable conspiracy theories because people could just take these emails and put them completely out of context and say this is representative of something much bigger, much more sinister, and then they'll write an article about it, and then it'll just go everywhere. And this is really what we've seen in the last number of months.
My guests are Terrence McCoy, socials issues reporter for The Washington Post, and Shira Frankel, cybersecurity correspondent for BuzzFeed News. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopez. We're talking about fake news. And Shira, you wanted to add something.
I did. I just wanted to say one of the really interesting things to come out of the WikiLeaks email drop was how that sort of reinforced people's views. The fact that they could go to WikiLeaks themselves and see the original emails seemed to really sort of give backing to a lot of these conspiracy theories. And I think it's one of the sort of side effects of WikiLeaks and the WikiLeaks effect that we haven't really even begun to understand.
But then we have these other kinds of wild stories that many people believe, like the one that Barack Obama is gay, Michelle is a transsexual, and the children were abducted, similar to the pizzeria story. Some of them are so outrageous, it's hard to believe anyone would believe them. Is it just a matter of wanting to believe the worst about the people you don't respect?
Yeah, I mean, I think the people who believe those articles are already so far down the rabbit hole. That they'll really believe anything they see that reinforces their worldview, that Obama and that Michelle are sort of these, the worst of the worst, that they've misled everyone and made their way to the White House, that Obama was a Manchurian candidate. I mean, they're really willing to believe anything about the Obamas. I do think that the vast majority of people will kind of look at those articles but not necessarily share them or believe them. They're a lot more likely to believe the things that link back to WikiLeaks, that have an email, and as Terrence said, taken out of context and clipped to sort of reinforce what they want reinforced. But they're more likely to believe that than I think the really sort of crazy out there pizza parlor and fake marriage rumors.
You mentioned Myanmar. Fake news has also become an international problem. What's the German government doing about fighting fake news on Facebook? Or haven't they threatened to take legal action?
Yes, they have. I mean, we've seen the EU and specifically Germany sort of be at the forefront of all this. They're taking it the most seriously, and they've posed the most sort of serious challenge to Facebook, saying that if Facebook doesn't do something to hasten its response time to removing fake news, that they're going to start taking actions to levy penalties and fines against Facebook. And it's the only government that's sort of forced a response out of Facebook. And Facebook has met repeatedly with them and said that they will do better and that they are working on the issue.
But that's because Germany has laws against hate speech, and there's been a lot of hate speech on Facebook.
That's exactly what I was going to say, is that all of this is interesting because all of this stems from Germany's hate speech laws. And the items that they've been the most upset about are those that was one that was, for instance, mapping Jews and Jewish-owned businesses across Germany. And that was repeatedly requested to be taken down off Facebook. Facebook did not respond until finally sort of very high-level German officials intervened and forced them to. So it all stems from Germany's hate speech laws, but they see a broader issue here, and it's going to affect their upcoming national elections as well. They don't want to see fake news spread in Germany the way it did in the United States.
A listener wonders if we're normalizing fake news by calling it fake news. Should we be calling it propaganda?
I actually made that same point on Twitter this morning, as I sometimes worry about calling it fake news because it, to some degree, euphemizes what this is, and it can be significantly more dangerous than that. To some degree, if people are doing it with a concerted point to say, I'm going to write fake news or I'm going to put this falsehood out there in order to make money, I mean, this is really just lie mongering. This is a concerted campaign to inundate the populace with misinformation to make money. And to that extent, I mean,
some of it, some of it, right? Some of it's propaganda, and others aren't. I mean, I think it's hard. It's very, very tricky. And of course, we want people to take it seriously. And I agree, like, fake news is not a perfect term. But I don't think all of it's propaganda. I think some of it is just teenagers in their basement trying to make money. And if it happens to work as propaganda in favor of one candidate or another, then that's just a side effect to them. So I'm not sure what the perfect term is, but I think we need to be careful about that.
But for most of us, the people who use Facebook as a news source, how can you tell whether a news story is real or fake? Aren't there websites that have very similar URLs to real news sites? There's one, abcnews.com.co, that's a fake news source.
That's right, and, yep. And it's not just that. There's U.S. Politicus, and there's a number of different variations of spelling in order to be able to make these websites URLs look more official and to some way that does hoodwink a lot of people, where they say, well, I recognize that brand, or it seems like an official source, so I'm going to click on it. I mean, it's to the same extent that a lot of scams have always worked. I mean, if you have the same sort of insignia, the same sort of similar-sounding name, people are more likely to believe it. But I think an important point here is the fact that a lot of the discussion that's going on surrounding fake news right now is really targeted a lot of folks who believe this stuff on the right. It is not exclusive to folks who are believing this stuff on the right. There are a lot of folks on the far left who believe the same thing. This is just a situation where folks on either fringe are believing more and more of whatever they can. I mean, there's been a number of false stories that were spread about Donald Trump as well during the election. It's not just one or the other. It's just a whole outgrowth of what we've seen with social media and misinformation.
Some tech experts go ahead, Cher.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, I think BuzzFeed actually analyzed the top left-wing and right-wing sites on Facebook and found that the top right-wing sites shared fake news. I hope I get these numbers right. It was something close to 32 or 33% of the time, and that the top left-wing sites shared it 21 or 22% of the time. So it's clearly an issue on both sides, but as you said, more on the right-wing than the left-wing.
Some tech experts suggest using a reverse image search to find out if a photo is legitimate. Can that work?
That's complicated for the average person to do. I mean, we do it when we're trying to check news stories, but I can't imagine the average American doing a reverse image search on everything that comes across their path. I mean, what I would encourage people to do is, no matter where they see the news item, they can see it on the New York Times, Washington Post, or BuzzFeed, but check it for yourself. Google it. See if it makes sense. I mean, I think that sort of the flip side of all this is that you can Google anything, and you can sort of look around for yourself and decide whether or not you want to believe a news item, no matter where it's published. And hopefully that's something people start to do more of in the future.
Thank you both so much for being on our show. Cher Frenkel is a cybersecurity correspondent for BuzzFeed News. Terrence McCoy is social issues reporter for The Washington Post. We've been talking about, I'm going to say, so-called fake news, because now supposedly we're told to say so-called alt-right. There's an awful lot of so-calleds out there.
Yeah.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Tiny Beautiful Things is a play about an internet advice columnist who writes under the name Sugar and works from her cluttered, toy-strewn kitchen. Some of the questions she's asked are silly, some are serious, and some are heartbreaking. Her warmth, vulnerability, and charm inform her replies as she struggles to justify, explain, sympathize, and accept all the little and big disturbances of humankind. The play, which was co-conceived by Thomas Kail, Marshall Heyman, and Nia Vardalos, is playing at the Public Theater until the end of December, and I'm very pleased that it brings Nia Vardalos, who also stars as Sugar, and Thomas Kail, the director, to our show now. And I said the end of December because I was a bit confused. Judging from where you look, it's either December 30th or December 31st.
Because we have a matinee December 31st.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm. Was this project the labor of love it comes across as?
Absolutely. This is Thomas speaking.
Yeah. My voice is so low because I haven't done
probably figure that one out.
I haven't done my vocal warm-up yet. I sound like a drag queen.
The book was given to me in the early summer of 2013 by my good friend Marshall Heyman, who's a wonderful writer. And Marshall is someone who always knows things about 4 months before everybody else, and he just said, I think you're really going to love this book and respond to this book. And I read the book over July 4th weekend, 2013, and just, this doesn't always happen to me, but I read the book and I started to see it as a piece of theater. I started to think about the idea of taking the private experience of reading and putting it in a public setting.
But this is so different from Hamilton, your last project.
Well, yes, except it is something...
No hip-hop here.
There is no hip-hop here. That is, well, Nia does some stuff in the green room, but we're not going to talk about that.
I like to beatbox before the show.
but the reality is, what's similar is that it is something based on source material that we were trying to honor. It's taking the story of someone that you didn't know about, and it's also, I think, in many ways, expressing the fact that we all have much more in common than we might think.
What did people who wrote to Sugar know about her?
Nothing, actually. They didn't. Some of them didn't know if she was male or female. They didn't know where she lived, what her income was, what her achievements were, and yet she would reveal herself to them in every column, never telling anything but the truth. So as they started to take these little tiny glimmers and put together their idea of a full person, she just was steadfastly herself.
At what point did she let everyone know that she was Cheryl Strayed?
She did it on stage one night.
In San Francisco.
Uh-huh. Yes. And
maybe after she'd published Wild?
No, it was before Wild had been published. She did this job while Wild was sort of in that holding period, being edited in the galleys and then like waiting to be published. So she just felt compelled to take this job on. This is a job that paid her no money. This is a job that was once a week that was anonymous, so she was not going to get credit for the work. Mm-hmm. Something in her made her feel that she had to do it, and she did. And then after about a year and a half, roughly, she had this event in San Francisco when she said, "I am sugar," and more importantly, "We are all sugar."
And why was she on stage revealing herself at that point?
She had pulled together the event so that she could go public with who she was. People were telling her, friends were saying to her, "Oh my gosh, you have to read this column. It's just amazing." And she was writing anonymously and couldn't reveal that, "Hey, guess what? I wrote that." And yet was at peace with that. That was okay with her. She says that she's terrible at keeping a secret. About 25 people knew. One of the tidbits I found is that she said, "By the time you finish reading this sentence, two more people will know I'm terrible at keeping secrets."
And that's one of the things that we were exploring in making it a piece of theater, because it is set in a real setting. Rachel Hauch designed a beautiful home. And this idea of being known and unknown was very central to Cheryl and to the experience of sugar. And yet, when Nia walks downstairs, there she is. There is sugar. All of a sudden, we do have information about her. And so it was very important that we did this one thing. The book is the book. We were trying to make something that honored it but is not the book.
But Nia, you said nobody knew whether it was male or female. Actually, her predecessor, Sugar, was a man.
Exactly.
Did he offer her the opportunity? Why did he pick her?
She had written him a fan letter saying that she liked the wit of the column. And he wrote her back, and I'm paraphrasing their exchanges, but he said, "I'm going to ask you something. I'm not going to do this column for much longer. No one's reading it. Would you like to take it over?" And so she wandered around for probably weeks and wrote lists of why she should not and should take this column, et cetera, et cetera, and then ultimately did it because she wanted to.
And what website was the column published?
The Rumpus, rumpus.net. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe it was the only fan letter he'd ever received.
Nia, didn't you write a column for the Huffington Post?
I have written columns, yes. I mean, I turned to screenplay writing because I couldn't get a job. I had written at Second City. There's material is not handed to you at Second City, so I learned how to write. But this is the first play I've ever written, the first book I've ever adapted, and it was a wholly satisfying experience from beginning to end. When Tommy gave me the book, he said, "I think this is a play." I read it on the plane on my way back to where I live, and I couldn't believe how it spoke to me in so many ways. All the pieces, whether I could relate to them or not, had a piece of wisdom in them.
And you said you couldn't get a job at the time. You're a very talented actor.
Go on.
I'll stop you there, Leonard.
And you made a big splash.
I mean, I'm going back in time. Yeah. When I got to Los Angeles.
Did they not recognize that talent?
When I got to Los Angeles, I could not get a job. And this was in approximately
1804.
Yeah. 1999, 2000, couldn't get a job. Wrote the screenplay of My Big Fat Greek Wedding. And that's how I broke into the industry.
And I gave Nia the book at the end of 2013. So mm-hmm. I wrote Cheryl an email. I found her email address, and I decided I didn't want to do it through agents. I didn't want to do it in a way that wasn't expressing myself directly, because here she was having written this book that was so honest. And I wrote her a very thoughtful and well-composed email.
Very good letter.
And she definitely did not write me back. So she dragged it over, as she says, to her to-do pile. And you know what happens when things go in your to-do pile. You don't do them. And so I gave the book to Nia about 4 or 5 months later. We were having dinner before she flew home. And I said, "Just read it on the plane. Tell me what you think."
How do you know each other?
24-hour plays on Broadway.
Yes.
Tommy directed.
There's this wonderful event that happens every year, and I was fortunate enough to have Nia in one of my shows, and I realized at that time that everything was going to be okay.
Is it true, as Oscar Eustace says in the program, that you were in the middle of doing tech for Hamilton when you gave the book to him?
That sounds about right, yeah. Well, you know, we were on a 10-minute break, so I needed to fill it with something. And it's, you know, this is the thing about, as Oscar describes it, the gift economy of this book is that I have given that book to 15 or 20 people, and everybody I give it to has given it to 15 or 20 people. And I was just part of that tree. You know, someone gave it to Marshall, Marshall gave it to me, I gave it to Nia, and we want to try to give this to the audience.
Mm-hmm. But isn't Tiny Beautiful Things thought of as a girl's book?
God, no. That's terrible. That would be like saying only girls have emotions. No, no.
Well, how many of her correspondents were men?
Probably 50%, if not more.
Because they suspected it was a woman, and they knew that a woman would probably give them better advice.
I don't know.
It is interesting that pretty much all advice columns, not all, but most advice columns, some written by men, some written by women, all had a woman's name at the top. Going all the way back to Miss Lonely Hearts. I don't know if you ever read.
Yeah, well, Dan Savage has done pretty well with his advice. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I think what Cheryl was understanding of in that moment when she was wandering around and Steve called her is that human beings need to feel connected to other human beings. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that transcends absolutely everything. And that's what we found in the experience of sharing this play mm-hmm. and watching people respond to very different moments, mm-hmm. depending on the audience, depending on the night.
A man told me recently at one of the dinners afterwards that he started to think about his childhood during one of the pieces that had nothing to do with childhood. He said it just took him absolutely all the way back to a walk on a seaside with his dad. And I was just weeping as he was telling me the story. So it's for both sexes. We see them out in the audience every night.
My guests are Nia Vardalos, who stars as Sugar in – did I say something wrong?
No, it's just
that. It's Vardalos.
It's Vardalos. But it's so okay.
She loves the city of Dallas.
The part of the problem with names that come out of other cultures is that you can pronounce them all sorts of different ways. My brother once, when I said, joining me now is Philip Lopate, he said, the name is Lopate.
Wow.
So, your brother's
But he was just teasing me.
That's pretty good.
Anyway, okay. Vardalos, Nia Vardalos, starring in Tiny Beautiful Things now at the Public Theater. Also here is Thomas Kail, who directed and is one of the adapters of can you explain how this play is structured?
Absolutely. And Nia wrote the play. My job as the director is to help put the pieces together, to help inspire and shape and edit. Nia is the person, as a friend of mine says, it's the writer who goes home with the stomachache and comes in with the pages. And Nia and I would have very long conversations. We would, you know, talk about order and how things are being distilled and what the arc of this might be. But this is a play that Nia wrote. And this is not a cut and paste job. Anybody that sees this play that knows the book, there is real artistry and craftsmanship in the work that Nia's done here.
That's so lovely. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm really pleased to meet you.
Yeah. Tommy and I have this relationship. It's hard to explain. When we met, we met doing a play in 24 hours. We got to get on stage and put together this thing, and we found, I think, a shared workaholic experience in each other. We like to work. We like to explore. We like to take things apart and start again. Tommy was there at the very beginning when I took the book, and we post-it noted which of the pieces we wanted to put in. And then I started to weave, and then I gave you drafts, and then we talked and talked and talked and talked and ripped things apart. So it's impossible sometimes to know where the process begins and ends with each other. It has been not a tiny, but a very beautiful thing working with you.
She's a real truth teller. I don't want to talk her out of that.
You want to mention the other members of the cast?
Yes, we do. We love them
so
much.
Yes, Nia, please.
We have three other members on stage. We are a four-person ensemble on stage. We have Natalie Willems-Torres. We have Philip James Brannan. And we have Alfredo Narciso. And these people, we float on this. We start with a hug before we go out. And then we get to, for 90 minutes, create this piece together. And every single time as we walk off stage, we find each other and we hug again. And it's such a beautiful moment because we've gotten to create something together, which is a through line of Cheryl Strayed's words. We get to create something together. And then sometimes we're lucky enough to find Tommy right there in the wings, and we want to pull him into our hug, and he goes, boo.
I'm not into this, you know, affection. No, I mean, I will say it's an extraordinary cast. And the way that the show is structured, the show is about 80 minutes long. Nia plays the role of Sugar, and these other three actors play 15 or 20 different characters throughout. So they never leave stage.
They're the people who write to Sugar.
Mm-hmm.
They're the people that write to Sugar. And some of those letters are 2-minute monologues, and some of them are 10-second bites. And so they're and yet each of them are carved out, and that's a credit to this cast.
And some of the things are predictable, and some are very surprising. Are there certain questions that Sugar got a lot, or certain topics that she was asked about a lot?
Love is a common topic that we...
So surprised.
No, we are... we want to be loved, I guess, is what I've taken away from reading the book and from conversations with people. And some of them are much more surprising. We wanted to explore everything, and it was like a Sophie's Choice in that we had to leave some things behind. But the book exists, and that's our favorite thing. We love it when someone says, I love this play. I can't wait to read the book.
Have you spoken to Cheryl Strayed about what she hoped writing the column would give her, considering the fact that she wasn't getting paid for it and it was going to eat up a fair amount of her time each week?
Well, how I began writing the play is a piece of one line that was in the book made me go backwards almost. I'm sorry to reference one of your many other works, but with Hamilton, the scene that you have where Angelica realizes that and reveals that she's in love with Hamilton is exactly the moment that I went backwards in the book. Cheryl Strayed created a column because she was seeking love. And it was the dearth of emotions that she felt in losing her mom very young. And that made me go, oh, backwards. Mm. And that's the place that I began writing from.
So she was writing this to find emotional clarity for herself.
Well, I mean, I think Cheryl can speak to this and has written about this. I mean, my understanding, having the chance to get to know Cheryl over these last few years, is that she is someone who deeply believes in letting other people know that they are not alone. And in that seeking, she is also understanding that it means that she is not alone. And I think that if you read, her novel Torch, and if you read Wild and a lot of the other, writing that she's done, this idea of these solo travelers who are trying to find other people to connect to, I think is really throughout the work. And I think that probably has something to do with why she picked up the pen and started writing.
How well known is Sugar? How much of your audience is already familiar with her and the writing? I'm not talking about from the book, but just from the things that she was writing as an advice columnist.
Well, she has the... She was a working writer when she took on Sugar. This is a woman who made a living, even if it was perhaps meager, as a writer before Wild. When people talk about Wild put her on the map, real writers and real readers knew who she was and loved her work. Why she took it on is, I guess, as Tommy says, she can answer that best herself, but for me, I believe it's that connectivity that she herself exudes constantly.
Did you think that from the way that she wrote that column that she has a lot in common with someone who's an actress?
I think she has a lot in common with all of us.
Because she's putting herself into someone else's shoes, which is what an actor does.
Radical empathy is definitely a through line that I relate to with Sugar's words.
And she was using the construct of Sugar as a portal, though. She was not diminishing or hiding who she was. She was actually, as she said, I reveal myself in every column. So the things that were true when she was Cheryl were the things that were true when she was Sugar. And I think, actors have a particular challenge, and I don't want to speak to it because, thank goodness, I'm not an actor. Really, that's more for the world's sake, is... you find the intersection between you and the character. You find the things that overlap in your Venn diagram of truth, and you access those. And I think that, what Cheryl certainly has, which I think this company of actors and so many actors that I've had the good fortune of working with, is just this incredible sensitivity and ability to code switch and find the frequency to understand how to connect and communicate is most effectively.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't she at the Public Theater with you this week doing a forum?
Yes, she's been a part of our process from the very beginning. When we finally made contact with her, Tommy and I talked as I was – Tommy lives in New York. I live in Los Angeles right now. And I was driving to meet her, and Tommy and I talked, of course, all the way there. And we talked – Tommy was like, tell her I wrote her an email. I was like, oh, I will. And we have really – made her feel so guilty for years about
not
answering.
I'm going to get wallpaper made for her for the living room the of email. That email.
But one of the things that we said, I said on behalf of Tommy to her was, we want you to be a part of our process, please. You are the creative engine. Let's go.
How do you see your job as a director in this play? Did you have to discover the physicality in it?
Absolutely, as I do with all of the work. And, you know, one of the things that Cheryl said, and then I also read that she... you know, subsequently, is she said when someone wrote her a letter, they didn't leave. They stayed with her until she could write the response. And I thought, well, there it is. That's the image. That's the sense of invasion. That's the sense of sharing. That's the collected experience that she had with these people that she never saw or would meet. So that gave me a clue that I wanted to set it in a real place. It was really important to me to start to play with some of the tension between who she was in her life and who she had to be, because she would write these columns in actuality Wednesday night, all night. They were due Thursday at 11. And so she would talk about that, coming downstairs, excavating her computer from the detritus and the sediment of her family, her very loving and wonderful family, and we all have these things, and trying to make space for herself. So that to me kind of set a journey into the, you know, into the morning, you know, that this weekly ritual she had could be something that we could experience in terms of an arc.
Mm-hmm. I relate to it because I'm a parent. I'm also an actor and a screenwriter. So when do I write? At night. I really related to Cheryl's process.
My Big Fat Greek Wedding started out as a one-woman show. Do you think that experience prepared you to see the potential for this book?
Yes. Actually, my Big Fat Greek Wedding, I had written the screenplay first but didn't have representation, so I jumped up on stage to do it as a one-person show. But one of the things Tommy and I talked about is that I really didn't want to do this as a one-person show. I've gotten that out of my system.
Yeah. Well, I didn't either. I mean, from the very beginning. It's the first conversation we had.
We want an ensemble. How many people was something that Tommy would determine.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In the film, the Greeks seem to love giving everyone advice. So.
Very true. It's very true.
But you never imagined this to be a one-woman show. It's important to have those very different personalities on the stage.
Yeah.
On the other hand, these are people who wrote feeling that they'd be anonymous. We would never see them. At the end of the play, Sugar goes upstairs and back to her private life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's all of us, isn't it? It's all of us in our day-to-day. We are not our job titles. We are the sum total of everything we give out all day. Mm-hmm. And Sugar, played by me, is Cheryl Strayed. Cheryl Strayed wrote this column, gave love, 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 and then went upstairs and was a mom.
And as we talked about with Cheryl, Nia is playing Sugar. Nia is not playing Cheryl Strayed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there is obviously so much from Cheryl's life that informs this, but it's important for us. We're trying to make a play that can be done in many places far beyond us,
mm-hmm.
in community centers and professional theaters and non-professional theaters. We want this to be an experience for a community to come together. And one of the things that we did in working with the folks of the public, and talking to Oscar Eustace and Maria, one of the producers there, is we have an early curtain time. Our curtain time is 6:30. And part of that happened for practical reasons, but then as we started to really think about it, we shifted it from 7 to 6:30 because I really love the idea of people walking out into the night and it's only 8 o'clock. And maybe they go and have dinner, maybe they have a cup of coffee, maybe they decide to walk across town or uptown or downtown and continue the conversation that has started. And I think that's what Cheryl's gift is.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about this private exposed thing that we were talking about. People write anonymously about very personal things. But, Nia, you wrote a very personal book about your desire and struggle to be a mother. What made you willing to go public with that story?
I realized that I had learned so much about the process of adoption because my husband and I adopted our daughter when she was almost 3 years old from American foster care. I'm a really private person. I know it seems like I mine my family for comedy gold, but the truth is that there are things that I will never put out there, and one of them is my private life about wanting to be a mother for 9 years. But I knew too much to keep it to myself. It would be like giving a recipe to a good friend and not including one of the best ingredients. So I wrote the book. We donate all the proceeds to Get Kids Adopted because it's a way that I feel connected to the fabric of society. We're all just a thread, aren't we? So I wrote the book. It's actually Katie Couric's fault, to totally name drop. She told me to write the book, and then she put me on her show.
Now,
Katie.
So you mentioned that you were hoping that that other people would also perform the show.
Yes.
What about this production? Is this it, the end of December?
Oh, you know, our job is to do the show tonight and then do the show tomorrow, and all those things will take care of themselves. We're so proud to be at the Public. It feels like exactly where we need to be right now, and to put this into the world, and then those things will reveal themselves. More will be revealed.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sugar shout out.
Thank you both so much for being on our show. It's been a great pleasure talking with Nir Vardalos. Got it right that time,
you're
right?
The best. Don't worry. It's all good.
And Thomas Kail. We've been talking about Tiny Beautiful Things, currently at the Public Theater, running through December 31st, a matinee on December 31st. And then with the new year, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir.
We're in the moment.
Writing another thing?
Yes, I am, actually. It's about a radio guy.
Uh-oh. I'm in.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.